This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFK. If you're not already a member, consider joining with us and keep free speech alive.
Spices on Los Feliz Boulevard. Special thanks to Neela. Pache in the heart of Laurel Canyon. Special shout out to Sandy and Scott. Leonore's on Victory in North Hollywood. Alegria on Sunset. Truly Vegan on Hollywood Boulevard. Zuberry Fields Forever, catering for all occasions. Our neighbor, Michelli's, thanks Joe, just down the street on Cahuenga Boulevard West. Takes, French restaurant on West Sunset Boulevard.
And many others.
When you visit these fine establishments, please thank them for donating to your favorite radio station.
Hi, this is Jamie Cromwell. You are listening to 90.7 FM KPFK Los Angeles and 98.7 FM Santa Barbara.
Hi, I'm Lila Garrett. Next on Connect the Dots, political analyst Michael Leidy questions the constitutionality of mandated private health insurance. David Swanson, author of War is a Lie, and suspended member of the Afghan Parliament, Malalai Joya, urge us to leave Afghanistan. Coming up right now on Connect the Dots.
Blink, that's my wake-up call. I'm slowly falling back to sleep, just in time for a mirror full of dreams to wash me clean. I reflect upon...
Good Monday morning. Welcome to Connect the Dots. I'm your host, Lila Garrett, watching the various factions chase each other around and around while the rest of us stand by anxiously awaiting our fate as this Congress comes to an end. The game they play in Washington, which is supposed to be the center of the people's business, is in fact an exclusive club whose squabbles we are occasionally allowed to witness. The backroom stuff is off limits. And when you dare to say, hey, wait a minute, you people are there because we voted you in. Our taxes pay your salaries. We pay to heat those halls of Congress you sell us out in. We pay for all those White House banquets. And when we say our taxes, we mean us, the little people, because the big guys who are invited to those banquets have just been let off the hook, permanently, by Obama's so-called compromise. Yes, I said permanently. Let no one kid you. Another 2 years in place will do it. Never underestimate the power of precedent. This was our chance to get rid of Bush's tax breaks for the rich, and Obama blew it. He could have let them expire on December 15th. We could have applied that $900 billion to the deficit, or even better, the stimulus. Instead, Obama went for a bill that not only gave the rich a free ride, it threatens the future existence of Social Security and raises taxes for a third of the middle class it's supposed to protect. This lame duck Democratic majority could have voted to extend unemployment insurance as a separate issue. All this could have been done before the scary new Tea Party Congress is seated in early January. If Obama, as president, spent his energy shoring up the courage of the Democrats instead of sucking up to this mean-spirited Republican minority, this Democratic Congress, which has only until January 4th to survive, could have accomplished it all. Instead, Obama defined compromise as capitulation, just as he did with the health care bill. Remember the public option? Gets more nostalgic every day, doesn't it? Well, that's bad enough. But the fact that Obama's health care bill forces we the people to buy private insurance is even worse. It's a dagger in the heart of our Constitution. As a precedent, it's as big a threat to our democracy as the Supreme Court's decision to give corporations absolute power to fund elections. But last week, however, there was promising news. Out of the blue, a federal judge named Henry Hudson of Virginia ruled that mandatory insurance is unconstitutional. We thought of this as a major victory for our democracy. But to our surprise, Judge Hudson was first attacked by the left for striking at the heart of Obama's health care plan, which keeps promising to be something it is not. And while the right cheered at first, then they did an about-face and attacked the judge for misinterpreting the law. Obviously, they had heard from the corporations who are salivating over our mandated money. So the question is, how long will Judge Hudson's ruling last? We'll ask Michael Leidy, Director of Public Policy for the California Nurses Association, to go into detail for us. And the one holiday that has peace on earth as its mantra is Christmas. We'll look at our earth and weep with those who are being liberated by our perpetual war. Malalai Joya, former member of the parliament in Afghanistan, will join us. And David Swanson, author of the new book, War is a Lie, will discuss Ambassador Holbrooke's last words before he died. "You've got to stop this war in Afghanistan," he gasped. What influence will the deathbed recanting of his previous position have on Obama and the military, if any? Let's begin with the good news. The New York Times last week reported, "Core of healthcare law rejected by U.S. judge. Mandatory insurance is called unconstitutional." With us now is Michael Leidy. Michael Leidy is currently the Director of Public Policy for the California Nurses Association, National Nurses United. He has spoken and organized throughout the country on healthcare reform, financing, and delivery issues. So, Michael Leidy, welcome to Connect the Dots.
Thank you, Lila. Great to talk with you again.
Yes, and it's wonderful to talk with you. So, let's review a little bit. We lost the public option. We lost single payer. We lost Medicare for all. And so we have this Obama healthcare plan. Michael Leidy, I remember you making a very stirring speech at UCLA in favor of Medicare for all and single payer and all the things we believed in. What do you actually think about Obama's healthcare plan, just for a brief review?
Well, the best you can say about it is that more people will get coverage through Medi-Cal or Medicaid. That goes up to 133% of poverty. Then you can say that there are certain insurance market reforms that improve coverage. That's the best you can say for it. What you can't say is that it actually guarantees health care to everybody, solves the health care crisis, or controls costs. And that's the real problem.
Now, you know that there is a judge, Judge Henry E. Hudson, who last week came out with a ruling which I must tell you, I responded to very positively, and that ruling said that mandatory insurance, which is included in the health care plan, is unconstitutional. Did you read that?
Oh, yes.
What I thought was unconstitutional in the first place, here's his exact quote, "At its core, this dispute is not simply about regulating the business of insurance or crafting a scheme of universal health insurance coverage. It's about an individual's right to choose to participate." What is your feeling about that part of the healthcare plan, the part that says that all of us must buy private health insurance, in a sense, whether we can afford it or not? I mean, they set the bar very, very low for people to have to pay that. The government is going to pay for really very, very poor people.
Well, we didn't need a conservative judge to tell us that the individual mandate is wrong. It's wrong as policy, it's morally wrong, and it very well may be unconstitutional, even if his legal reasoning isn't as solid as it could be. The fact is that it's outrageous that individuals are forced to buy a product, private health insurance, that doesn't meet their needs, that's too expensive, that undermines the quality of care because of the imperatives insurance companies impose on providers, and really just doesn't guarantee people the kind of health security they need. So the individual mandate is fundamentally wrong. It's the premise of this healthcare reform because it's the way that the insurers got bought off. And it's really a mistake, I think, on the part of progressives to support the individual mandate because it is really the insurance company's insurance policy to guarantee profits.
But the left has responded to this very, very negatively. They feel that he's really blowing Obama's healthcare plan. They're talking about this healthcare plan more enthusiastically every month. I mean, it's gone from being a very unhappy compromise to being the second coming.
I'm afraid you're right. And that's the problem with this reform, is that the political dynamic is such that because the Republicans are so against it, progressives in the Democratic Party believe they have to support it, regardless of merit. Right? We have to support the president. No Democrat ran for re-election on the basis of supporting the health care plan. It's at best got mixed support among the public, about 50-50. and yet, you know, progressives feel compelled to defend something that they would never have actually initiated on their own, but only in this political context of defending Obama or taking on the Republicans do they then jump in and say, hey, this health care law is a good thing. And it's very bad policy, and the politics are ultimately, I think, undermine progressives' moral authority to the extent that they take that position.
Now, the right wing had a very interesting response to this. The left was immediately against it because they felt it would just blow Obama's health care plan out of the water if it was allowed to stand, because this is a federal judge. He can be overruled, can he not?
Well, he can be overruled by the Court of Appeals. You've got conflicting district court decisions. This guy, I mean, look at Hudson, has a stake in a Republican consulting firm that opposed the law. So we don't want to agree with Hudson, and some of his legal reasoning is problematic. He is a partisan political figure who shouldn't have ever been allowed to render a decision. So that's really kind of a separate question.
But it's an interesting question, don't you think?
It is very interesting, actually.
Because when you read his statement, it sure sounds reasonable to me. It's like he had a fit of conscience, you know? He suddenly had an attack of conscience, and he just simply laid it out there. I mean, what could be simpler than at its core, this dispute is not simply about regulating the business of insurance or crafting a scheme of universal health insurance coverage. It's about an individual's right to choose to participate. I know I've read it before, but I can't get over how cool it is.
Well, it's interesting because he's kind of right. If the reform really were about providing universal coverage, right, you wouldn't necessarily rely on an individual mandate. You'd do Medicare for all, right?
That's right. Well, he's going that far. But I'm saying, I mean, the man has said it. I feel exactly the same way. No one is to the left of me in the entire world. Let's just assume that, you know?
Right.
And this man is completely right, you know, no matter what he's involved in. So what do we do about that?
Well, I think that it's right that we can use this as a way to say, really, the individual mandate is fundamentally flawed, and individuals should not be forced to purchase a private product that just guarantees the profits of the companies. And we do really need to fight the individual mandate. If you take away the individual mandate, then the whole scheme doesn't make sense. And at the same time, we need to open the door and say, let's really solve the problem. And I would really like to get beyond the merits of the Obama plan and back to a discussion about what's the best policy to control costs and guarantee everyone health care. And that debate is still the better debate. I think we need to have that in California, and I think progressives ought to be focusing on that rather than trying to defend something that really is indefensible.
But don't you think that this could lead to reopening the whole reconsideration of single payer? I mean, this is the first real challenge to Obama's health care plan since it passed. Now, what happened with the right, because I've been following this very carefully, is that the Republicans at first were very, very quiet, because the papers all said, well, this is a boost to the conservatives. And I couldn't find any way that it was a boost to the conservatives, because what it meant was that the insurance companies were not going to get our money. We are not mandated, if this thing goes through, to pay for the insurance companies our good, hard-earned money.
Right.
And then, obviously, the insurance companies got to the right, and suddenly they're all screaming about this and saying, no, no, Hudson's considerations were wrong, and he's absolutely wrong, and this is not unconstitutional. So I really think it's hysterical.
Well, that's pretty funny, considering that part of their political strategy is to undermine the law legally, and they really are cross purposes between their insurance company donors and their supposedly libertarian politics.
You know, the right wing sometimes is so stupid. It really takes your breath away, doesn't it?
Well, as our research director here says, stupid is the new smart, Lila.
Well, I love the nurses, and I love it that they said that. You know, it's just the best union around. There's no question about that.
Well, thank you.
So now my real question to you, Michael Leidy, is this. How do we take advantage of this and use this to reopen the healthcare discussion? Because it really does need to be reopened.
Well, see, Lila, this is what I like. If the policy debate were focused on, are you going to be forced to buy private health insurance, or do you want a system like Medicare for everybody? That's a beautiful debate to have. If we can contrast single payer to the individual mandate, vast majorities of people would choose single payer, because it's just obviously wrong to have to buy private insurance. And a system covering everybody like Medicare, which is very popular already, seems to me a winner for us, and we ought to press that debate.
But I haven't heard anybody do it, so I'm really trying to get you.
You saw, modest Huffington Post from Jamie Court, a consumer watchdog. I think we're going to see more of this. I think it's going to have to come, you're right, from really the single payer left, because the liberal establishment that supported the Obama plan isn't going to do it, as you've said. And I think it's also a question of timing, too, right? Because I want to have really us in a much stronger political position, particularly in California, before we really engage and re-engage the fight for health care reform.
Now, you know, we can think of this Judge Henry Hudson, who's supposed to be a real right-winger and really invested in pharmaceutical companies and all of that. I mean, the first thing they do, both the left and the right, when they disagree with a politician is they smear him or her.
Right.
They say
right.
Throw everything at them, you know,
right.
True,
right.
False, anything in the middle, it doesn't matter. And yet, this man, he's a little bit like Wendell Potter. Isn't he? I mean, Wendell Potter is a CEO from the healthcare industry who recanted.
Yeah, the communications director from Cigna.
Now, if we could turn him, Judge Henry E. Hudson, as in the river, he's certainly known for a good guy. Yeah,
that's right.
If we could turn him into a Wendell Potter, we would really have something.
Well, and you're right. And we need to exploit and be smart about exploiting that populist wedge between those who say, hey, let's do the insurance company's bidding and reverse our position and say the mandate's good, versus those who understand the mandate as a violation of conservative principles regarding individual rights, or liberal principles regarding individual rights, for that matter.
Well, we actually do agree with this. I mean, let's not use the word exploit. Let's just say that we actually do agree that it is unconstitutional to force us to buy insurance from insurance companies, to force citizens in a democracy to buy anything from a private company. That's like the mafia forcing you to buy protection as a merchant. Protection from whom? From
right.
them.
Exactly. As Roseanne DeMauro, our executive director, says, even the mafia doesn't take 30%.
Yeah, that's true.
Which the insurance companies do.
Yeah, well, if this thing stands, and I don't believe the right wing or the left is going to let it stand, we really have something to work with here, because the thing that disturbed me most as an individual about the health care plan, and almost everything about it disturbed me, it's full of lies. I mean, it really does not protect everybody. I mean,
right.
If you have a previous illness, they simply outprice you.
Exactly. If you don't regulate rates, none of those reforms really do much, and certainly not nearly as much as they promise.
So I really do believe that this was a violation of our Constitution, and that should really concern us more than anything. So, Michael Leidy, I leave this in your capable hands, because I have heard you speak several times, and you really have inspired me.
Oh, well, thank you, Lila. I appreciate that. Yeah. And we are going to carry on this fight, and we really appreciate your support.
And I appreciate your continuing this fight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Michael Leidy, who is the Director of Public Policy for the California Nurses Association, National Nurses United. We're going to change the subject, and we're going to talk about the spirit of Christmas in what I believe is the most compelling way. It's interesting that Christmas is the only holiday that calls for peace on earth and goodwill to man. Isn't that amazing? We have so many holidays, and the only holiday that stands up and is counted for peace is Christmas. We're very, very proud of it. We sing beautiful hymns to it. And then Christmas passes and we proceed to accelerate the war and send in more troops and continue to fund them and so on and go right back to our permanent war economy and our permanent war behavior. Well, a year ago, almost today, we spoke to a woman who made a wonderful plea for peace in her country. She was the youngest woman ever to be voted into the Afghanistan parliament. And eventually she was suspended from that parliament because the parliament itself was so warlike and so corrupt. But her plea for peace in her country, in Afghanistan, is so moving that we've decided to replay it. She made this plea almost a year ago today, and it is because of her plea for peace that we are presenting this as the true spirit of Christmas. With us now is Malalai Joya. Malalai Joya was a 27-year-old member of the Afghan parliament. She was elected to the 249-seat National Assembly in 2005. Malalai Joya won the second highest number of votes in the province. She rose to fame in December of 2003 when she spoke out publicly against the domination of warlords. She wrote a book about it called A Woman Among Warlords. Since then, she has survived 4 assassination attempts and travels in Afghanistan under a burqa and with armed guards. In 2007, she went on Afghan television and said that the legislature of her country is, quote, worse than zero. After that, she was found guilty by the parliament of violating Article 70 of the Rules of Procedure, which forbids lawmakers to criticize one another. In consequence, she was suspended from the parliament of Afghanistan and banned for 3 years. So, Malalai Joya, welcome to Connect the Dots.
Thank you. Thanks for this interview.
And thank you for being courageous enough to stand up for democracy in your country. We know it's a great risk for you. And there have been, according to my notes, 4 attempts on your life since you have spoken out against the warlords. What are these attempts like, and what do you do to avoid them? How much danger are you in Afghanistan?
I come from Afghanistan, and I will go back to Afghanistan. There, still I'm underground activist with burqa and bodyguard, even not safe. As you mentioned, that a number of assassination attempts they did against me, and they want to eliminate me. Even inside of parliament, when I was there 2 years before, they beat me by throwing bottles of water, and they threatened me even to rape inside of parliament. And even one of the wanted criminal, like Sayyaf, Abdulrab Rasul Sayyaf, he said to one of his commander in the parliament, beat her a few times with knife after that. She will know who are Mujahideen, etc. And many risks like that. I have defense lawyer right now in Afghanistan, but they do not allow me to go back to the parliament because there is no justice. And the last answer of these parliamentarian in the complaining commission of the parliament was to my defense lawyer, instead legally discuss about my case, which is quite a legal act because I'm elected member of the parliament. But they threat to date my defense lawyer and telling to my defense lawyer that we expelled her from parliament is not enough. We must punish her with GAN, with Kalashnikov. Inside of National House, still they are talking with the language of GAN. But I'm honored that my people, these suffer innocent people of my country, they did not leave me alone. In Kabul, I'm changing safe house to safe houses. And also, I'm meeting appointment with some victim families, those girls who has been raped. You can see some clips on my webpage that some Democrat journalists coming in Kabul, they have interviewed with me and raised the voice of these voiceless people against these injustice there. And for example, you can see clip of Bashir, a 14-year-old girl who has been raped by 3 men, one of them son of the member of the parliament. This girl is 14 years old. And this member of the parliament changed the age of her son less than 18, that do not be punished. And he is right now enjoying in the parliament, and her son is free, that continue to his crime. There is no justice. Then what I'm doing underground, I'm trying to give a little hope to these kind of victim girls, because they say the government do not listen our voice, we kill ourselves.
What you've just described, and I really didn't understand all of it. What I did understand was that the word parliament really does not apply to Afghanistan's parliament. It is not a body which is making laws by which the people can live. What it sounds like is a series of very threatening warlords who have a lot of power, and as though there aren't really laws that have been created that the people can live by. Is that true?
You know, our constitution in 2003 that we made, first election in Afghanistan, that this constitution has some shortcoming, especially regarding women rights. It's not very clear. But if we put this constitution in practice, if democrat system we had, democrat government and justice-loving democrat people come in power, it was possible that this constitution put in practice. But now we have Jenga law in Afghanistan. This constitution is a beautiful thing in the shelf of Hamid Karzai, to deceive people around the world.
So you do really have a constitution, and you just said if it was put into practice, it would be a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Now President Obama has told Karzai that he has to put these laws into practice, that he has no choice. He has to put them into practice. And my question to you is it possible that Karzai will become a different person and suddenly say to the warlords, you know, get out of here?
and stop attempting to rule or we will punish you? And can he possibly turn this around and make Afghanistan a democracy?
I think this 8 years after 9/11 until now is enough to know better about Hamid Karzai, this shameless puppet man who did compromise with these fundamentalists, with these warlords, and now negotiating with Taliban. And during his campaign, he invited Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, this fascist man who has names in the blacklist of the UN, and also Mullah Omar, this terrorist man, also to join the government. And he chose two criminal men like Qasim Fahim and Karim Khalili as vice president. Now, two buddy of Hamid Karzai is two wanted criminal. Human Rights Watch recently said that Hamid Karzai insult the people of Afghanistan, but I'm saying he's betraying. Even Hamid Karzai did sign disgusting law that fundamentalists, Shia fundamentalists in Afghanistan during the election they made against Shia's women. In the parliament, this law has been passed because Democrat men and women are very few. They raised their voice against this law. Nobody listened their voice. Anyway, this law, despite national and international condemnation, even has been passed by Hamid Karzai. And now Mr. Obama is saying to Hamid Karzai to support, means that to bring positive changes in Afghanistan, which is impossible. Situation will be more disastrous, especially for the women, because I told you only Mullah Omar and Gulbuddin is not in power. And if really Mr. Obama honest for Afghan people, he must apologize to my people and criticize the wrong policy of the Bush and stop arming the warlords. Mr. Obama said Dostum is a criminal. He even mainstream media wrote against Dostum as a wanted criminal. But even Dostum during election, this non-democratic election, came in Afghanistan and wrote to Karzai. Why Mr. Obama do not raise the voice against that?
So do you believe that President Obama is really looking for a way to pull our troops out of Afghanistan, or do you believe that he has no intention of doing that?
You know, President Obama now search more troops in Afghanistan, quite similar like Bush. And more troops, this 8 years we experienced that, which bring more conflict, more war. Now my people sandwiched between two powerful enemies. From the sky, occupation forces bombing, killing civilians, most of them women and children, and the ground, Taliban and warlords. So with the withdrawal of one enemy, these occupation forces, it's much easier to fight one enemy instead of two. I said condolences to those family, American mothers and other mom in Afghanistan who they lost their son as a soldier. I told them, please raise your voice against the wrong policy of your government, and I said condolences to them. Mr. Obama, if really honest for Afghan people, in the meantime, he must stop arming these warlords, end occupation, support the justice-loving people of my country. We have a lot. Still, they are underground activists, and also, together with UN, he must stop neighbor countries like Iran, Pakistan, Russia, Uzbekistan, who support Taliban, and also these warlords. Democracy never came by war, by cluster bomb. They say the war of Iraq is bad war of Afghanistan is good war. War is war, and also regarding official reports, more civilians has been killed in the period of Obama than criminal Bush.
Let's talk about your trip to Washington, because you went to Washington to speak to a number of congresspeople about your country, about what's going on in Afghanistan. How many congresspeople do you think you met with, and how did they greet you? Were they willing to see you? Were they sympathetic with you?
A large number of them I met, members from Senate, men, women, and even some of them were not there. They passed messages with some of their staff I met. But with some of them, really was hopeless. Just to waste the time. Even they don't want to listen that their government occupied Afghanistan, which is so clear. And some of them, they at least listened to me. And also some of them, they really supported. They said, yeah, we are agree. But let's see. I said the message of my people. I condemn the wrong policy of their government. And I discuss about the disaster situation of Afghanistan. In this cause, they were agree. Yeah, situation is disaster. But in this part that the troops leave Afghanistan, some of them, they didn't want, as I told you, even to listen. But I told them, and I stress on this comment, that they occupy the country, impossible to bring democracy by sworn enemies of these values. These warlords, they did civil war in Afghanistan from 92 to 96. You can see Human Rights Watch website. And also some group of the soldiers, troops, who were in Afghanistan and Iraq in the past, and now they refuse to go to Iraq and Afghanistan. They said, we don't want to be war criminal. This group of troops also was with me, these soldiers. And they also supported me. And they said, yeah, this war is bad war. And they said they are witnesses there, what they saw when they were in Iraq and Afghanistan. Anyway, but hopefully they pass the message to their government. As I told them, the silence of good people is worse than the action of bad people. We have many justice-loving, democratic-minded men and women. Some parties, Democrat Party, we have more than party intellectuals we have. Still, they are underground activists. I told them, please support them and stop arming these warlords.
Now, you know that the United States has a war economy. And what that means is that the largest industry in the United States is the arms industry. And we call it the military-industrial complex. And that really is the largest source of income for the United States Treasury, aside from taxes. So it's not likely that the United States is going to stop arming all of Afghanistan. What they might do is pick a faction in Afghanistan and arm that faction. And that's what they probably are doing now. They are arming tribes that are fighting against the Taliban. Do you believe that the United States is also arming the Taliban?
You know, today many report directly and indirectly they are supporting Taliban as well. And right now, for example, this report that even Hamid Karzai himself said that a few days before to BBC that in Kunduz province, in Samangan, in Baghlan, in the north of Afghanistan, during the night, unknown helicopter bringing our men. And they are also more insecure than through mainstream media, as still they are betraying the truth. They say this propaganda, there is not security, Taliban getting powerful, let's surge more troops in Afghanistan, and many propaganda like that. And also in Kandahar province that recently these occupation forces, they threw arms, gun, and also food in the area that in Kandahar, which famous in the name of Taliban, that there is lots of Taliban. And this gun and all this food Taliban receive, then they say thank you to the occupation forces. Then their government says that, oh, sorry, we did a mistake. We didn't know that there is Taliban. How they don't know when mainstream media and also the media in Afghanistan, they say that there is lots of Taliban. And many reports I got nowadays that receiving more reports that today, directly, they are supporting Taliban. Today, one member of parliament is Talib, Mullah Abdul Salam Rakati. He raped three Chinese women when he was commander of Sayaf, this warlord, then became commander of Taliban. Even he is running for the presidential election, this tragic drama of election. White House never raised a voice against that. Why? Because we have in our constitution those accused as war criminal must not run for the election. Today, foreign minister of Taliban, Mullah Mutawakkil, has good life in Kabul. Ambassador of Taliban, Mullah Abdul Salam Zaev, has good life in Kabul. And for U.S., maybe they are pro-U.S. terrorists. Maybe for U.S. government, they are moderate. But for our people, they are not, because they didn't said apologize to my people. And never expose the crime. How my people should trust to them?
If you were the president of Afghanistan, surrounded by warlords, and the main product that was grown in your country were poppies, which is what's happening now, how would you proceed? What is the first thing you would do? If it was you instead of Karzai, because it sounds to me, based on what you said, that this is a man who is surrounded by criminals.
Yeah.
And his own life is
you
in
know,
jeopardy.
He was not surrounded by warlords when in the first time that he came in power. My people, between bad and worse, they voted to Hamid Karzai, because in the beginning that he came in power, before of the first presidential election, means after 9/11, after Bonn conference, when he came in power, he did compromise with the warlord. He was silent. But during first presidential election, he promised to my people, I never do compromise with the warlord, with these draglers. If you vote for me, But my people, millions of people, they voted to Hamid Karzai to show their hatred to the warlords between bad and worse. Because in the meantime, the wanted criminal, these warlords, even Taliban, ran for the election. But he betrayed the vote of my people. Again, he started compromise with these warlords, drug lords, with these puppets. Even New York Times wrote, brother of Hamid Karzai, Ahmad Wali Karzai, is a famous drug trafficker, and he received millions of dollars from CIA. So if I was, instead of Hamid Karzai, if any other Democrat, justice-loving people of my country was, instead of Hamid Karzai, that while we have a lot in our country, high-educated professors, very good people, some Democrat parties, a lot of intellectuals we have, there is no honorable job for them. But if they, instead of Hamid Karzai, one of them come in power, the first step that they did, I was sure, they never did compromise with the tested enemies, with these warlords who are photocopy of Taliban. At least he resigned from the post if he couldn't do anything. But he did compromise with them. That's why today Afghanistan is safe haven for terrorism. At least he must try it as a president of the country that superpower countries support him, and with 40 more countries who occupied my country this 8 years after 9/11. At least as a president of this kind of country, he raised the voice and tried to bring these wanted criminals, these bunch of killers like Sayyaf, Rabbani, Kanuni, Dostum, Mullah Omar, Ismail Khan, Gulbuddin, that they are around him. He brought them to the National and International Criminal Court. At least he raised the voice that I don't want that they come in power. When Taliban come in power, they become mice, these warlords, skip in their holes.
When the Taliban is in power, even though they're cruel and they are unjust and they treat women barbarically, there is sort of an order. Is that what you're saying?
No. I said when Taliban, these terrorist people come in power by support of the CIA, this Taliban has been created in the religious school of Pakistan by support of Saudi Arabistan. Anyway, these Taliban, like warlord, they are product of the CIA, U.S. government. And now, unfortunately, NATO, this 40 countries also supporting these warlords still. But when Taliban, these warlords come in power, Taliban, these terrorists come in power, the warlord who did civil war in Afghanistan before of domination of Taliban from 92 to 96, when Taliban come in power, they escaped. Yeah, the warlords escaped in their holes. They become mice because they were puppet of CIA and ISI mainly. But after 9/11, back these mice become wolf. They become supported by CIA, and now 40 more countries support them. And now these wolves, they are in the skin of lambs, deceiving people around the world. With suit and tie, they are in power. They are like Pinochet, like Hitler, like Franco, like Mussolini, Bush. They are like these people, but they are in power, still continue to their fascism.
But my question to you, I mean, it really sounds like a dangerous, kind of hopeless mess at the moment, Malalai. But my question to you is, if you were the president, if you were in Karzai's position, what's the first thing you would do?
First of all, I want to tell you, I want to serve my people. I never thought that I will be president. But if I become president, as you said, yes, of course, first of all, I tried my best next to my people. I'm sure most of my people hate these bunch of killers. They are just a bunch of names. But full of shame. I tried to bring them to the National and International Criminal Court. First of all, I said these occupation forces must leave Afghanistan. As our history shows, we never accept occupation. And secondly, together with these democratic-minded, justice-loving people of my country, we have a lot. Together, we must try to build our country and give the chance to them. And they were ministers, they were members of the parliament, and they were in power. And also, as a president of Afghanistan, I tried educationally support my people. While, see, lots of money, millions of dollars they received from the international community. If educationally support my people, because education is a key toward emancipation. Today, my country, my people, they had even some of them that Taliban and these warlords deceived them. They were not deceived. So if I was president of Afghanistan, I made schools, literacy courses, even in the dark provinces and faraway cities, because, as I said, education is the main key toward emancipation.
So you believe that the first thing you would do is educate the people. You would ask those people who are occupying your country to get out, and you would bring the warlords to the international court. That sounds like a very good plan. It doesn't sound like something that's going to happen without the cooperation of Obama, but at least it is a plan. Well, we're very glad to have this opportunity to speak to you. We will do this again, and you're always welcome at KPFK. And we will be in touch with some of our congresspeople who didn't welcome you as warmly as we hoped that they would, and make sure that on your next visit you are much, much more warmly welcomed.
Yeah. I told them that the silence of good people is worse than the action of bad people.
And on that very, very wise advice, we will close. Thank you so much for joining us, and we wish you all the safety and luck in the world. This interview took place a year ago. Since then, we have done nothing but escalate the war. Malalai Joya is back in Afghanistan. She still gets daily death threats. She is surely one of the bravest women in the world. With us now, to continue our pursuit of peace on earth, is David Swanson. David Swanson is the author of the book Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union, and of the introduction to the 35 Articles of Impeachment and the Case for Prosecuting George W. Bush. His newest book, War is a Lie, is currently in bookstores everywhere. David Swanson, welcome once again to Connect the Dots.
Great to be here, Lila, as always.
And, you know, it's Christmas and it's the new year. We think it's very appropriate to have you as our guest again because you have the greatest message of all when it comes to Christmas, the only holiday, at least in English, that says peace on earth, goodwill to man. And that's what you're all about. Now, I do want you to read this wonderful open letter from the Afghan youth peace volunteers that they're sending out to the world about the necessity for peace. And in it, we really get the intensity of our attacks on this helpless nation. When I read it, I cried. And now I want to invite my audience to cry with me. But before we do that, let's talk about something that perhaps we'll choose not to shed so many tears about, and that is the passing of Richard Holbrooke. What was your feeling about Richard Holbrooke? He was a very, very important American diplomat, maybe the most important American diplomat of our time, wasn't he?
Well, you know, we talk about diplomacy as what we would prefer to war, as if the two are different. And yet, if we didn't know it, what we're seeing in these WikiLeaks cables is the extent to which diplomacy has really become a servant of the Pentagon and of the CIA. And Richard Holbrooke has been a big part of that. He has been a war maker, not a peacemaker, not one who goes out of his way to avoid war, but one who facilitates war through the pretense of diplomacy, just as we go through pretenses of legalism when we lock people up without charge. This is a man who worked with Henry Kissinger in Vietnam, who worked with Jimmy Carter on efforts in East Timor that provided the weapons that blocked the UN resolutions that resulted in hundreds of thousands dead in East Timor. This is someone who supported horrible sanctions against Iraq and bombings of Iraq, who supported the Iraq war lies, who, when Clinton was president, supported ethnic cleansing by one side, not the other, in Yugoslavia, and who, far from achieving peace in Yugoslavia, imposed on Milosevic a choice of a treaty that absolutely no government of any nation in the world would ever accept, complete subservience to NATO, immunity for all occupiers, an endless occupation, or be bombed. And so it was diplomacy as the facilitation of a bombing campaign that, in the opinion of many, made things worse and saw the escalation of crimes on the ground rather than bringing them to a halt. And then most recently, of course, Richard Holbrooke has been in charge of the so-called civilian operation in Afghanistan, which our counterinsurgency experts coming out of the Vietnam tradition say is the path to hearts and minds, and we should put 80% of our money into it, and we're putting about 3% of our money into it. This is a man who talked about that job as a way to support the military in Afghanistan, who was asked repeatedly by senators in a hearing earlier this year what in the world the point was in Afghanistan, what he was doing, what they were trying to accomplish, and had absolutely no answer. And so it was remarkable on the day that he was reported to have passed away that the Washington Post reported his last words to have been, "You've got to stop this war in Afghanistan." And when a lot of people started remarking on that and talking about it and even proposing legislation that would accomplish it and honor it, The Washington Post made clear that they believed he had been joking. And my understanding was that they thought it was absurd that anyone would have imagined such a statement to be anything other than a joke. This, of course, despite the Washington Post's own polling showing a majority of Americans wanting to do just that, stop the war in Afghanistan.
Well, maybe the spin is that he was just joking, but the New York Times, the next morning, Wednesday, December 15th, said in its most important column, the column on the right on the front page, U.S. intelligence offers dim view of Afghan war. Dispute with military. Classified reports cite Pakistan's failure to curb insurgents, which was kind of a complaint on the part of Richard Holbrooke anyway, wasn't it? That they didn't feel that Pakistan was doing enough to support the war.
Yeah, nobody, including the American public, seems to be doing enough to support the war. That Washington Post article complained that the war had been plagued by all sorts of factors inhibiting its progress and success. And this death of Richard Holbrooke would be yet another factor plaguing this war. And among those listed was the unpopularity of the war among the U.S. population, which you would think that we could have media outlets in a representative republic that would consider it their obligation not to figure out how to support something that is plagued by its unpopularity among the people. But among the insider crowd, the people among whom Richard Holbrooke operated, there is just such contempt for ordinary people that things like disapproval by the population of a war are considered hurdles to be overcome. I would never tell anyone not to shed tears over the passing of a human being, but I don't think that our public policy loses anything by losing Richard Holbrooke.
Still, it is interesting that his last words were, "You've got to stop this war in Afghanistan." Recanting at the last moment is a very big thing among people who lived an entirely different life, you know? I remember Lee Atwater, who was, you know, sort of a double-crossing Karl Rove type of politician, doing exactly the same thing. He played every dirty trick in the book to help, was it Reagan or was it Nixon? I forget which terrible president he helped to elect.
Oh, and Bush Sr. with that Willie Horton, the prisoner, yeah. Criminal advertisement.
And Lee Atwater was absolutely ruthless. I'm sure that he was Karl Rove's idol because they're mirror images of one another. And yet, on his deathbed, he recanted. And the world seems to have forgiven him. And the world is mourning Richard Holbrooke, not as a human being, because as a human being, we don't really know him. But as a diplomat, they are mourning him. At the same time, the Los Angeles Times on Wednesday, December 15th, said, "Grim reports cast doubts on war progress," which means that his last words had more influence than all the other words he offered throughout this war, this 10-year war.
I've just been reading today a book called America's Misadventures in the Middle East by Chas Freeman, and this is another longtime career diplomat, been involved in everything for decades, like Holbrooke, and who was appointed last year by Obama to chair the National Intelligence Council, and then was immediately forced to resign because he had made comments that were just a little bit too accurate about Israel. And he will be driven out of public service and forgotten. And when he dies, there won't be this outpouring of corporate sentimentality. Richard Holbrooke pleased the same people who sold us these wars, the same people who are lynching the leader of WikiLeaks for filling us in on what our government's been doing. You know, somebody like Chalmers Johnson, whom we lost recently as well, found it in himself to turn against what was happening long before his last moments on his deathbed. I think that is where we find significant about faces. I think our heroes, our whistleblowers like Smedley Butler, who engage in war crimes for decades and then become leading voices against them, are much more valuable than people who seriously or jokingly or in a way that nobody will know for sure find some truth and beg for some forgiveness in their last moments. I don't think that does us much good.
No, it doesn't do us any good. Unless this New York Times article, U.S. intelligence offers dim view of Afghan war, and the L.A. Times grim reports cast doubt on war progress, you know, 2 days after Richard Holbrooke died, are making people rethink this war. First of all, let's remind our audience that we are speaking to one of our favorite guests, David Swanson. And he is the author of War is a Lie, which is a wonderful book. It's a reference book that really, I feel at this point, I can't do without. I mean, I can't find one war that wasn't trumped up. But how much influence, lasting influence, do you think that Richard Holbrooke's last words, "You've got to stop this war in Afghanistan," which he said to his Pakistani doctor, "You've got to stop this war in Afghanistan." It was very dramatic. Browning could have written it. You know what I'm saying? It just has that kind of a poetic flavor. And it is Christmas, and we all do tend to get a little spiritual about now. How can we capitalize on this and say, you know, finally a man who knew more about this war than maybe anyone, any individual, he was there from the outset, has looked at the situation in probably the clearest moment of his life, the last moment, and said, "You've got to stop the war in Afghanistan." How can we make people understand, or make the government understand, that he was seeing the truth?
Well, I don't know if we can be sure ourselves, much less convince everyone that the Washington Post is convincing otherwise, that he was serious. It's entirely possible that he was serious. It would have been a moment of honesty, a deathbed conversion from the religion of militarism to honest statesmanship. But I can't know what happened. I don't think there's videotape. I think that it is a moment now to use it as a catalyst for a conversation that is also facilitated by this review that the president is supposed to put out at least a summary of on Thursday, a review of the Afghan war, which is going to decree that by the end of 2014, we will rename it a non-combat war. That is, we will remove all the combat troops and just have the non-combat troops engaged in combat beginning in 2015. And I think that that is outrageously unacceptable. I think that the people of the United States, if for only financial reasons, if for only reasons of preserving a civilian government with any sort of popular sovereignty, ought to be up in arms about. And I think that it's wonderful timing with Veterans for Peace leading civil resistance at the White House the same day that this report is coming out. I hope that we can kickstart a new peace movement. And if citing Richard Holbrooke and all of the other experts in the Pentagon, in the White House, in the WikiLeaks cables, the European Union that says it's hopeless and pointless and they're continuing it out of deference to the United States, any of those voices can help us, then by all means we have to use them. But I think people like Anne Wright, who resigned, I think Matthew Ho, who resigned, I think people who, while they had a lot of life left in them, stepped out and started resisting, are the real heroes to point to.
Let's not let the Washington Post decide for us what's a joke. I wrote comedy for 30 years, you know, and I know a joke when I see one. "You've got to stop this war in Afghanistan" is not a laugh line. It's not even a straight line. He meant it. As I project myself into his dying mind, it seems to me that what you say to yourself is, okay, I don't really believe in God, but in case I'm wrong, here's what I have to say. I'm sorry, God. I didn't really mean it about killing all those people in Afghanistan. I'm for stopping the war. And that's what I think it is. It's recanting just in case there is a God. So on that cynical note, you were just talking about the fact that the peace movement is really getting another jump start from Veterans for Peace. What date is that they are demonstrating?
Thursday the 16th, there's a civil resistance action at the White House with people who've been involved in supporting WikiLeaks and who will be doing a press conference at the National Press Club earlier that morning with the Australian group Get Up that is supporting WikiLeaks, Daniel Ellsberg, Ray McGovern, etc. There should be dozens of people possibly chaining themselves to the fence at the White House, certainly risking arrest in the bitter cold to say, enough's enough. We have to end these wars. A majority of people are against them, and the government seems to be invested in attacking the messengers who tell us anything about what's going on.
Now, we have to remind our audience that we're doing this interview on Wednesday, December 15th. So when we talk about the 16th, it really is tomorrow. But for those of you who hear this program, it really was last week. And you'll know by now what the results were. Now, we have in front of us another peace group that's extremely profound, and we're hoping that their message gets out. And you sent me an open letter from the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers and Afghans for Peace. Usually around Christmas time, I sing my own version of Silent Night, but I've decided this Christmas to spare my audience that, and instead to talk about the message of Christmas, which is peace, and have you read this statement by the Afghan Youth Peace Movement. And it's entitled, We Want You Out, an open letter from the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers and Afghans for Peace. And David Swanson, you're on.
The letter begins, to all the leaders of our world, the leaders of the U.S.-led coalition, the Afghan government, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and regional countries, we are intolerably angry. All our senses are hurting. Our women, our men, and yes, shame on you, our children are grieving. Your Afghan civilian military strategy is a murderous stench we smell, see, hear, and breathe. President Obama and all the elite players and people of the world, why? America's $250 million annual communications budget just to scream propaganda on this war of perceptions with its nauseating rhetoric mimicked by Osama and other warlords is powerless before the silent wailing of every anemic mother. We will no longer be passive prey to your disrespectful systems of oligarchic, plutocratic war against the people. Your systems feed the rich and powerful. They are glaringly unequal. They do not listen. They do not think. And worst, they do not care. We choose not to gluttonize with you. We choose not to be trained by you. We choose not to be pawned by you. We henceforth refuse every weapon you kill us with, every dollar you bait us with, and every lie you manipulate us with. We are not beasts. We are Afghans, Americans, Europeans, Asians, and global citizens. Yes, you have the false, self-appointed power to arrest us over expressing the public opinion of ordinary folk, students, farmers, shepherds, laborers, teachers, doctors, people who now have nowhere to turn and nowhere to hide. This world public opinion against the Afghan war has been clearly expressed and is larger than any number of WikiLeaks you seek to suppress. So come arrest us all. As we civilly disobey you, come arrest us all. Yes, you have the army, police, and apparatchik to smother us and to bribe those who are Pavlov reflexed to money, but you cannot stop us from restoring our voice. We refuse to prostitute our hearts and minds. We refuse you. Not you, the human person, but you, the greedy system of self-interested power. Again and again here in Afghanistan, we have seen a hope for nonviolence light up. Every day we see a yearning for humane relationships, and because of this, love is how we now firmly take our stand. How does trillion deficit killing, followed by the strategy of escalated killing, and yet another review for more killing work? How does it make anyone safer? How does it solve the incorruptible corruption, unequaled inequality, and inviolate violence we face daily? Your policies, skewedly diagnosed and reviewed in a cold clinical manner divorced from reality, have been deaf to the concerns and needs of the people. Thus, we endeavor to have a People's Afghanistan December review, because that's what ordinary people can do. We would try not to throw our shoes at you. We would try to recognize the better side of all human beings and thus continue to serve our commoners' tea and bread to one and all. But we do ask, plead, and demand that you stop your unsustainable superpower militarism. We want peace. We want you out. With singular sincerity, Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers, Afghans for Peace.
Well, with that profound plea for peace from the Afghans for Peace, most of whom are young children and mothers and fathers, we wish you all a peaceful and happy Christmas, and certainly a peaceful new year. And that's our show for today. We thank our guest, Michael Leidy, who is the Director of Public Policy for the California Nurses Association, Malalai Joya, who was the youngest woman ever elected to the Afghanistan Parliament, and David Swanson, author of the new book, War is a Lie. Our theme, Nobody Knows, was composed and performed by Keaton Simons. You can find more of his music on iTunes, MySpace, and KeatonSimons.com. Connect the Dots was edited and engineered by Mark Maxwell. It was created and hosted by me. I'm Lila Garrett. If you would like to hear this or any of our shows, log on to kpfk.org. Scroll down to Lila Garrett or Connect the Dots. And there we are, listed by date and guest. Every show is online for 90 days. You can also join our interactive Facebook fan page, where anything and everything related to Connect the Dots and the progressive movement will be showcased.
Just search Lila Garrett, Connect the Dots on Facebook, and become a fan. We hope you'll join us next Monday morning at 7, when once again we attempt to connect the dots.
Hey, yo, what up, y'all? This is Nas, here to tell you about the 4th annual Drum Day giveaway in South Central L.A., hosted by Leon Mobley, December 26, 2010, from 2 to 8 p.m. at the Barbara Morrison Performing Arts Theater in Lamar Park. All ages welcome. Free food, live performances by legendary drummers, my man Leon Mobley, and dozens of drummers, dozens of different drums. You know what I'm saying?